Dharma. This is a Sangha. I've been speaking of compassion, love, and wisdom. Yesterday I introduced into these, I added the dimension of the three pure precepts, which I think provide a lot of illumination on what compassion, love, and wisdom are really describing. Today I want to talk for a few minutes about the nature of the challenge represented by each of these aspects or stages of the spiritual life and so forth, or training. Clearly the challenge of compassion, the more passive form of love, is a challenge of being more still, keeping focus. You can think of it as just the challenge that presents itself in a typical period of formal meditation. That's a good place to start thinking of this. It's also the challenge represented by the first pure precept, cease from evil, or you could put it, do not do, refrain from doing that which is not good to do. Or you could put it even more simply, first of all, start out any course of action, first try to do as little harm as possible, given all the circumstances of your situation. All of these are ways of approaching, or all of these are ways of approaching the challenge of this aspect or stage of our training. But of course, if we were to stop there, the emphasis might get quite rigidly stuck on the not doing rather than the doing. River Master described getting stuck in the first stage of compassion as a kind of living death. And this is why she did that. If you get stuck in the not doing harm, where your main focus is on not doing harm, that will eat away at everything that you do. It will diminish everything that you do. There's more to life than simply not doing harm. If you try to carry the not doing harm too far, you end up being like the kind of legendary Jainist sage who would literally stand in one place and starve to death, because to make any movement with the body would be to possibly step on an ant or some other little animal or insect creature and kill them. So you carry the not doing harm to the point of absurdity, of course not realizing that one is then doing harm to oneself. One is literally destroying one's own body in the name of not doing harm. Although that's a kind of reducto ad absurdum, there's less extreme ways in which for each of us, we at times tend to get stuck in this side of things. And it's amazing that the kind of goofiness that one can justify in the name of not doing harm. that can become a classic way of avoiding certain kinds of responsibility. And in particular, the kinds of responsibility that manifest so frequently and sometimes so unpleasantly in that second stage or aspect of training, the more active stage of love, where you're not only focusing on refraining from doing that which is not good to do, you're actually attempting to do that which is good to do, to discern it and to do it. And this can involve a lot more seeming risk. Though I have to say that getting stuck in any one of these aspects involves great spiritual risk. We don't want to get stuck anywhere. So the challenge in that second stage is to discern what is good to do and then to muster the will to do it. Sometimes we get our eyes open to what is good to do going through the school of hard knocks, where we try some other things and they don't work, and eventually we're forced to accept something that we find difficult to accept. Her master, in her discussion of this stage of training in the chapter in Zen's Eternal Life entitled The Heart of Samantabhadra, focuses in particular on the kinds of difficulties and the kinds of demands put upon the teacher who has to give teaching that isn't much fun to give, and presumably not much fun to be on the receiving end of either. But clearly, there's a lot more to it than this particular situation that she's describing. In truth, anyone who truly accepts the responsibility that manifests naturally in the course of their living is going to be faced from time to time with these kinds of very difficult situations where you can't please everyone, where you can't make everyone happy, where you may have to do things that are risky and difficult and sometimes acutely painful. And one simply cannot be a responsible human being without the willingness to do the things that are hard to do when it's good to do them. We don't go out seeking the things that are hard to do. They come along frequently enough just in the course of living. And sometimes, as I said, it takes an effort just to see what it is, just to bring oneself to recognize what's actually right in front of one's nose, but one doesn't want to see. This particular aspect or stage of training is usually characterized in terms of a patient endeavor, kind of patient effort. And I think that in general, that is a very good way to describe it. because when we're dealing with things that are karmically tangled and difficult, as is so often the case in this aspect of training, you have to exercise patience. You can't untie the knot all at once. You have to be content to pull on a thread at a time. Another metaphor that our master used a lot is to shave the cheese rather than try to chop big chunks off of it, to shave the cheese. And in the midst of difficult circumstances, that kind of patience itself can be very difficult to practice. Take a lot of effort. Some of that is the effort of restraint, and some of it's the effort of actually doing the things that are hard to do as they come down the pike. You might say that we're talking about, in a way, different stages of willingness. Although, in the fullest, deepest sense, willingness is just willingness, and you can't really cut it into pieces or talk about it in stages. Still, there is something to it. That when more is asked of one, one has to dredge up the willingness from a deeper place, as it were. And that is certainly the case in the third of the stages of the aspects, the heart of Manjushri, the practicing of wisdom. There the willingness has to be full and unconditional willingness. Because there the surrender to the eternal needs to be so deep and so pure. Sometimes people have noted that foolishness and wisdom are not so remote from one another as one might think. And it's really a good idea to always remember that. You could say that we have a kind of inborn kind of foolishness in our humanity. That when we come right down to it, we don't know very much. And sometimes what we do know just gets in the way. Or what we think we know gets in the way. In order for wisdom to manifest naturally in our lives, what little we know or think we know must not be allowed to get in the way of the guidance that comes directly from the eternal. And if that guidance from the eternal is going to be able to come through loud and clear to us, or soft and clear, more often the case perhaps, but sometimes loud and clear, then we're going to have to be conscious of our own depth of need. There's no room for complacency here. It's the person who is willing to get down on knees and bow and truly ask for help, who is able to hear the voice of the eternal. It doesn't just happen by accident. It comes right out of the depth of our humanity. Our humanity and our Buddha nature are not remote from one another. Our karmic inheritance and the enlightenment of the eternal are not remote from one another. Our deepest spiritual need and the help that can come to us and through us to others from the eternal are not remote from one another. This is one of the greatest misunderstandings of the nature of the spiritual life. When people think of spirituality, they think of something remote from their humanity. But it is never remote from our humanity. Therefore, a foundationally important and basic aspect of wisdom is that we prove over and over again to ourselves in our own experience that everything that happens is for our good. And that there is nothing that is so dark and confused, so anguished and grieved, that is separate from the love of the eternal. So again, willingness cannot be cut into pieces and is not a matter of stages. And at the same time, to go the full way in our training and in the spiritual life, does ask of us that we come to the place again and again of complete and utter willingness. So that the eternal can make use of us in whatever way is truly good for ourselves and for all living things.
To all the bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the